Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film award season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
People are dead after a shooting at a newspaper in Paris. Police say a masked gunman with an automatic weapon stormed the offices of the French satirical newspaper and opened fire.
Fighters from the Islamist group Boko Haram in Nigeria seized yet another strategic town over the weekend. The Council on Foreign Relations estimated up to 10,000 people were killed in 2014.
As Iraqi and Kurdish forces advance on the Iraqi town of Tikrit, the militants of the Islamic State hit back, apparently beheading a Western journalist.
Security in Kabul, Afghanistan has stepped up this morning after deadly shooting at a luxury hotel. Nine people, including four
gunmen, are reportedly holding dozens of hostages in a Sydney Central Business District Lent Cafe. News footage shows the hostages were forced to hold up a flag with Arabic writing on it.
Video of a shooting possibly involving numerous gunmen inside Canada's Parliament in Ottawa this morning.
News reports about some of the recent violence committed around the world in the name of Islam. The latest, of course, the murder of 12 people at the Charlie Hebdo offices in Paris. As we just heard in the news, the two brothers who allegedly committed those murders were killed by police earlier today. In a separate incident, Paris police also killed a friend and ally of the brothers. He was holding hostages at a kosher supermarket. And today, reports that the Islamic militant group Boko Haram killed hundreds, perhaps thousands, this week while overrunning the town of Baga in northeast Nigeria. We're going to spend the first part of the show looking at the role of religion in these violent attacks. George Packer is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. His latest article is titled, "The Blame for the Charlie Hebdo Murders." Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, this is such a complicated and sensitive issue. Should we even ask why this violence in the name of Islam, or do we have to analyze every situation individually?
Well, I think you have to do both, because on the one hand, each of these places, Nigeria, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, France, Holland, Canada, the U.S. are all different, and different factors go into the pushing of mostly young men into radical acts of violence. On the other hand, something is going on around the world and really all over the world, everywhere that Muslims live, it seems, maybe with a few exceptions, which is to say a strain of thinking has infected Islam today that is that has taken over the minds of a pretty substantial minority of people, and that is leading to horrific acts of violence, and it is within that religion that it's happening. So I don't see how you can avoid the question, why is it happening? What is it about Islam? And I don't say Islam as the text of Islam or as some essential and eternal set of ideas, because I think religion is the acts and beliefs of those who adhere to it. So you have to ask yourself, what is it about Islam as it is lived and understood today that keeps producing these atrocities all over the world?
So you're not saying it's the religion itself encouraging the violence, but how people are interpreting it. Well, so what do you think? Why is it that people are interpreting it in this
way? I think the religion itself is the way people interpret it. I guess that's what I'm saying. I don't think there's any distinction. So I wouldn't just look to the Quran
the text, for the reason. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would look to the ideas, the statements, the beliefs and the acts of its adherents. And the reasons are very complicated. It's been going on for several decades now. This is not new. It's just happening now with more frequency, maybe with more savagery, and really in more parts of the world than ever before.
Well, some people argue that this Islamic extremism is a reaction to Western actions in the Middle East, support for autocrats going back decades, and also the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So does the West bear some responsibility for the rise of this militant Islam?
There are always proximate causes. The Charlie Hebdo cartoons were a proximate cause. But you have to ask yourself, why does it keep happening? Why is it that whenever one of those causes is taken away, for example, the presence of Western troops in Iraq, there's another cause somewhere else, and that has to do with the fact that this is an ideology that is deeper and more historically entrenched and larger than simply the policies and actions of this or that country. It's something that exists in people's minds and in their mosques and in their thinking and in their talking, and it can't simply be attributed to reactions. It preceded some of these events, and it has outlived some of these events, so you have to look a little deeper than that.
Right, and so you have the goal from AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the goal of establishing a global caliphate. So is it possible to say that the religion in this case is a veneer for the struggle of political power, or are the two just intertwined?
I find it very hard to disentangle them because in this case, religion and politics are almost inseparable. The ideology is a religious ideology. It comes from one of the great religions of the world. On the other hand, it has also led to and is motivated by a desire for power and for political power, and has political consequences. So, you know, communism was an ideology that was not attached to a religion, so it was easier to say this is not about religion, this is about ideas and about power. Islamism is about ideas and about power, but it's about the ideas of religion. So it's religion as politics, and it's politics as religion.
So how does the West, how are we to make sense of this without engaging in generalizations about the religion?
Right, because the analysis I just gave doesn't tell you what to do. It doesn't include a prescription. And although it suggests a very large ideological problem, the answer I don't think is a large and indiscriminate ideological answer, because as you said at the start, there's so many complications in the different situations we find, whether it's in the suburbs of Paris, where there's disaffected and angry, unemployed and just pissed off young people who are from Muslim backgrounds in the Middle East and North Africa, or Syria and Iraq, where it's much more a sectarian clash between large communities of people, where everyone is a Muslim. It's just very hard to generalize, and generalizing usually doesn't help find answers. The answers have to be tailored to each situation, and they have to be very nuanced and discriminating. And force is seldom a good answer, because this is, as I said, something that is going on in people's heads, and you don't change minds simply through violence.
Well, as the Egyptian president has said this week, maybe it's time for Islamic religious leaders to step up and try to change the ideology.
It's been that time for a long time. After every one of these major atrocities, there's a call for moderate Muslims to have the courage to take on members of their own faith and to risk the public shaming or even the violence that might come with that. And some of them do. And the speech by President al-Sisi, who happens to be a military dictator, was one of the clearest and most encouraging. But it never quite seems to be enough. The jihadists and the extremists always seem to get the last word and to get the most attention and to have this incredibly intimidating power, not just with their fellow Muslims, but with all of us.
George Packer, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And joining us now is Reza Aslan. He's a writer and religious scholar. His latest book is called Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Welcome, Reza.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. George Packer, he said earlier that religion it's not just a set of texts, but the living beliefs and practices of its adherents, and that Islam today includes a substantial minority, those are his words, that believe, even if they don't carry it out, that violence is a legitimate tool. And I'm wondering what you think of what he said.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, religion is about the lived experience of an individual in a community, which is why all religions come in almost infinite varieties. And And why I often say it's much more significant what an individual brings to a religion than what that individual gets from his religion. And it is also true that there is a substantial minority of Muslims that have been infected by this sense of radicalism. But it's not a mystery what that radicalism is or where it comes from. It has a single source, and that source is what is often referred to as Wahhabism, a puritanical, Arabocentric version, austere, orthodox version of Islam created in Saudi Arabia at the end of the 18th century, which became a part the state ideology of Saudi in 1932, and in which over the last 25 years, the Saudis have spent upwards of $100 billion spreading that ideology to every corner of the world. And these are the results of it. Boko Haram is Wahhabi Saudi ideology. The Taliban is Wahhabi Saudi ideology. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, all of these have a single ideological source. It's not a mystery.
Right. And so from your point of view, is that more of a political push, or as this is pretty much the same question I posed to George Packer earlier, or a religious ideology, or is it something of the two?
And his answer was spot on. There is no difference between the two. The only thing that he's wrong about is that indicating that somehow Islam is unique in that sense. It's not. There is no difference between the two in almost every religion in the world, and that includes American Christianity. I mean, there's a reason why something like 94-95% of our Congress are self-described Christians. I think that we have to understand that religion is less about the things that you do or the things that you believe and more about who you are. And as such, it engulfs your political and cultural and national identity. So you can't say, well, is it religion or is it politics? Because those two things really bleed into each other.
Okay, so when you're talking about this Wahhabism, this rise of Wahhabism and the spread of it throughout the world, are you then also describing what is basically could be described as a civil war amongst Muslims between extremists and moderates?
That's certainly how it's described often. I would go even further. It's not just sort of two positions battling each other. It's thousands of positions battling each other. You have to understand that Islam is the second largest religion in the world, a religion of 1.6 billion people. It will very soon be the largest religion in the world. And yet, it's a religion without a center. There is no Muslim Pope. There's no Muslim Vatican. There is no single religious authority with the power to define who is and who is not a Muslim, what is and what is not proper Muslim behavior. So essentially, anyone who calls himself a Muslim is a Muslim. Anyone who says that they are doing Islamic practices is doing Islamic practices. And there's really no sort of measure whereby one can or cannot be declared as Muslim or Islamic. So what you have is thousands of competing interpretations, thousands of voices all sort of fighting with each other for supremacy. It's not a coincidence that the voices that we only tend to hear are the voices of radicalism and extremism, because they tend to be the loudest voices. But it's not two sides in this argument. It's thousands of sides in this argument.
So then what do you say to people who say it is in the nature of this religion, Islam, to encourage this kind of these kinds of violent attacks? And that, yeah, sure, people are interpreting it, bringing to it what they want, but it is in the religion itself. I've heard this argument made many times after attacks such as the ones we saw in Paris this week.
Well, look, if you're going to blame Islam for acts of violence carried out in Islam's name, then you have to credit Islam for every act of compassion carried out in Islam's name. So if you're going to say that ISIS is Muslim and that says something about Islam, well, so are the victims of ISIS. So are the people who are fighting ISIS. So, you know, I think that there's a fine line between saying that, yes, of course there's a religious motivation for some of these acts of violence, but what that motivation says in a general way about the religion itself, not much, really.
Yeah. Well, what do you think of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Egypt calling on religious leaders to take a stand and for there to be some kind of religious revolution?
That message is utterly useless coming from a man who is currently presiding over one of the most dictatorial police states in the world, in which he is randomly slaughtering people on the streets, as he did with the Muslim Brotherhood a couple of years ago, and who is you know, forbidding press freedoms, freedoms of speech. I mean, look, this is one of the worst dictators on the planet, and nothing that comes out of his mouth is worth much to anyone. What we really need is more sort of political and religious leaders who are carrying on that torch. Now, despite what I think most of your audience thinks, the voice of condemnation against these acts of violence is absolutely deafening. It's so loud. But the truth of the matter is that it doesn't really make that much of a difference to these militants. You have to understand that if you're a member of ISIS, you think that Islam is the problem, that these clerics are the problem, that the political and religious leaders of the Muslim world, they're the enemy. So anything that they say is not going to really work. But nevertheless, I think it's important for those voices to be heard. They're out there. They're just not getting, I think, enough attention from the media.
Reza Aslan, writer and religious scholar, author of the book Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, and No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. Reza, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up on the program, what is real? The story of a man who truly believes he's being haunted by the ghost of Montgomery Clift. The coincidences are pretty striking. Listen to his story. It's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. You know, we all have our demons, our ghosts from the past that haunt us. But for Craig Chester, well, his ghost is a little different. Actually, a lot different. Craig's an actor, a writer, and director based here in Los Angeles, and he seems like a pretty smart, funny, and grounded guy, but a series of events led him to believe, and I mean truly believe, that he was being followed around by the ghost of actor Montgomery Clift. His fascinating and kind of troubling story is the subject of this week's Unfictional. That's a show here on KCRW, and Unfictional host Bob Carlson joins me now. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
All right, so Craig Chester, who is he?
Craig is an actor and a television screenwriter, mainly now. He writes for True Blood, among other things, or did. And in the early 90s, he acted in some high-profile gay films, and he was a director of a film called Adam and Steve, which is kind of considered sort of a milestone gay film. But at a certain point, he stopped the acting part, and now he's just mainly a writer.
All right, Montgomery Clift, screen actor from the 50s and 60s, famous heartthrob actor in the Rock Hudson vein. He starred in From Here to Eternity, A Place in the Sun, and he was closeted. He was gay, and he was closeted. How was it that Craig began to believe that Montgomery Clift was his ghost?
Well, the first time that this idea came up was when he was at a point in his career where he was still interested in making sort of interesting, small, independent films. But because of the success of some of his earlier films, he started getting these offers from Hollywood to do like bigger budget things, but like, you know, mud wrestling movies and just movies that he thought were not the kind of thing that he was wanted to spend his career doing. So he was sort of at a crossroads. He kind of like he was being offered this thing. He didn't know whether he should take it or he didn't know what to do. So one of the actors in the film that he was working on at the time suggested that he go to a psychic. This was in New York. And so he went to this psychic named Reverend Catherine. So he kind of went in, said, you know, whatever you say to a psychic, you know, what should I do? This is my thing. And she says, well, none of that is important. What's important is that you are being followed by a very good looking person who I don't know, but I can. He's telling me that he is a gay former actor from the 50s and 60s. Well, his first thought was like, this is not helping me in my career decision. But then he said, okay, is it Rock Hudson, and she says, no, he didn't like Rock Hudson.
The ghost didn't like Rock
Hudson. Yeah, yeah. Is it Anthony Perkins? No, it's not Anthony Perkins. Is it Montgomery Clift? And she says, yes, it's Montgomery Clift. Then she goes, spills out this whole thing. You know, he's been following you for most of your life. He wants to sort of live vicariously through you because you have these freedoms as a gay actor that he never had in the 50s and 60s. He wants you to write his biopic. He's been waiting for this moment for years.
Wow. So what does he do with this information?
At first, he's just kind of disturbed by it, and he doesn't really know what to think of it. So he just kind of puts it out of his head for a while. And then he comes back to L.A., and he's at a dinner with some friends of his father's, a woman named Josanne and her husband. And so they're asking him, and he's sort of like entertaining them with stories about who's gay in Hollywood, like all the secret, you know, people who are gay in Hollywood. And, you know, he says, it's always been this way. And he goes through the same list. There's Rock Hudson and Montgomery Clift. And Josanne, who was kind of wasn't paying attention, she immediately comes to life and says, this guy who you just mentioned is standing right behind you.
I didn't know she was a psychic. She's not a professional. She just does it for the sake of helping people. She sat up and turned away as if she was listening to something.
I mentally asked this energy right next to Craig, are you this guy? He said yes.
And then she turned back to the table and she's like, Craig, this Montgomery Cliff guy,
he's attached to your hip right there, you know?
She doesn't even know who Montgomery Clift is. She said Cliff without the T at the end.
So that's Craig Chester in your documentary. And it's not just that. There are other coincidences, too.
Yeah, I mean, it goes on from that. Now, he starts taking it a little more seriously, Craig, now that this has happened twice. And he sort of decides to go with it a little bit and find out where this is all going to take him. And he rents a house in L.A. And one day, Josanne calls him and said, okay, Montgomery Clift is here. He's ready to start writing the biopic. And even though Josanne's never been in this house where that Craig has rented, she started describing and says, where are you? Are you in the little alcove right by the top of the stairs? And he says, yeah. And she says, oh, that's where Montgomery Clift likes to hang out. So for the next several months, just these weird things just happen like out of the blue. Like at one point, Josanne says to him, you need to get a hold of this guy, Jack. I don't know who Jack is, but Monty says you got to get a hold of Jack. And Craig, by this time, knew a little bit about Montgomery Clift, and he knew that Jack Larson was this actor who had played Jimmy Olsen in the old Superman television show. And the two of them sort of had a clandestine relationship. And he's still around. He's still living in Los Angeles. And so he looks in the phone book, and there's like 60 Jack Larsons in the phone book, so he doesn't know what to do. But the next morning, his friend calls him up and says, hey, you know, I'm having lunch with this guy that I think you should meet. His name is Jack Larson.
No.
So these things would just happen without Craig doing anything. And there, just a few hours later, Craig was talking to Jack Larson.
So does Craig believe that one of the reasons Montgomery picked him is because he's a gay man in Hollywood and that he's open about it and that Montgomery Clift never could be?
That's at a certain point, he just started taking at face value what these psychics were telling him. And that's what they were saying. The two of them had a lot of parallels. Montgomery Clift had this horrific car accident at one point, and his face was completely disfigured. It was smashed and had to be rebuilt. And Craig, when he was younger, he had grown up with a deformed face, and he also had to have reconstructive surgery.
Although he does, in your documentary, he seems self-aware or aware enough to realize that to other people, this all sounds a little crazy.
I remember going out to lunch with this acquaintance of mine, and I think he noticed that I looked really tired or something. And I'm like, I'm just going through this experience, and I don't know what it is or what's happening, but I think Montgomery Clift is haunting me. And he looked at me and he said, oh, I completely understand. A few years ago, I was walking through Union Square, and I heard a flower talking to me. And I picked it up, and it was the ghost of Charles Lindbergh. And that was a moment when I thought, I'm never telling anyone ever that this has happened to me. That's your biggest fear, is that people are going to think that you are thinking that flowers are talking to you.
But Bob, this does take over his life. He ends up spending a lot of time talking to these psychics.
Yeah, he becomes kind of obsessed with it. He visits the Lincoln Center. They have the Montgomery Clift collection, which is sort of Montgomery Clift's sister had donated scripts and various personal effects of Montgomery Clift's that are there. And so Craig starts visiting there to do research. And at a certain point, he starts feeling very strongly that these are his objects. And at one point, you know, he has to wear these gloves. He takes his gloves off because he wants to hold these objects. And the guard tells him to put his gloves back on. And Craig has this thought in his head, like, these are my things. And so he's aware that he's starting to lose his mind a little bit. And around the same time, he had just started this new relationship with this other guy, Brandon, and they moved to New York together. This was Brandon's first time in New York, and he's all excited to, you know, sort of live New York lifestyle. But all Craig wants to do is talk about Monty, and it becomes literally like a love triangle between Craig, Brandon, and Monty.
You know, Brandon would come home, and he would want to do things, and I'd be on the phone with Josanne or Catherine talking to Monty, and he would be upset with me.
I could do anything I wanted to do in New York City, and there were endless possibilities. And then I would come home, and then we'd be talking about, like, Monty.
The more that I talked to Monty through Catherine and through Josanne, the more that I felt truly understood.
It sounds so weird. It sounds so crazy. But yeah, how do you compete with a ghost? I can't.
I felt understood in a way that Brandon could never understand me, in a way that no guy I'd ever been with had gotten me.
I love you. I've loved you since the first moment I saw you.
What happens to Craig's relationship with Brandon?
Well, it pretty much ends because there's a moment when it's Craig's birthday and Brandon had helped organize this birthday party. And then during the birthday party, a friend of Craig's, and this is another one of those weird coincidences, a friend calls and says, hey, I just got invited to this cocktail party at Montgomery Cliff's old brownstone in New York. You want to come? Just completely out of the blue. And so Brandon says, all right, I can't compete with this. Go ahead. And so Craig leaves the party to go to Montgomery Cliff's brownstone. And I think both of them, Craig and Brandon, both sort of feels like that's the moment where it kind of split, where he sort of, Craig could choose one and he chose Monty.
Was Craig in love with Montgomery Clift?
Yeah. I mean, that's what it seems like.
Yeah. And what about this biopic? Is he going to do this biopic on Montgomery Clift?
Probably not. It seems like that was sort of the point of the relationship between Craig and Monty in the beginning, but it became less so. It became more of a general thing where Monty was kind of mentoring Craig in his career and sort of guiding him and giving him advice and telling him to not settle for the cheap movies, to, you know, stick to his artistic visions. And it became more of that, of a mentor relationship.
And is that continuing or is it over?
I think it's still continuing. I know that Josanne still can talk to Monty, but I don't think it goes on as much as it was at one time.
I mean, do you believe this? Do you believe that there is a ghost that is speaking to Craig?
You know, I don't know. I don't really think about it. I don't care. I think it's a really, really great story. And when you have, and how do you fact check something like that? When you have a great story and you have this many people who are part of it, who are all telling it sincerely, to me, it's just a great story and I don't really care. Is that a cop out?
I don't know. I don't know. Well, you can hear that great story tonight at 7:30 on KCRW. Bob Carlson, thank you for coming in.
No problem. It was a pleasure.
Bob Carlson hosts and produces Unfictional on KCRW, and you can hear his full story tonight at 7:30 here on KCRW and KCRW.com. It's called I Am Montgomery Clift. Coming up, some living movie stars and what they're starring in this week. Our regular Friday film segment is next after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We have officially entered the movie dead zone. That is January, which means you could just go see the Oscar buzzing movies that came out in December. But if not, we have the new releases and movie industry news today with Alicia Malone, host of Malone's Movie Minute. Welcome back, Alicia.
Thanks for having me back.
My pleasure. And William Bibbiani, film editor for Crave Online. Welcome, William.
Hello.
First up,
You're welcome.
That.
Yeah.
It's very radio.
Sexy.
All right, first up, let's hear a clip from Predestination.
I haven't been entirely truthful with you, Jane.
About what, sir?
I work for an organization whose primary purpose is not space travel. It's reshaping wrongdoings. We use Space Corp, among others, as a means of finding people who are special. They are what you might call a recruitment agency.
I don't understand. A recruitment agency for what?
Okay, so this stars Ethan Hawke and an Australian actress named Sarah Snook.
Yes.
And I'm going to go to you, Alicia, your fellow countrywoman.
Yeah.
Who
and
is
it's,
she?
It's directed also by the Spierig brothers, who are an Australian duo, and they worked with Ethan Hawke a few years ago on a low-budget vampire movie called Daybreak. Now here comes Daybreakers. Now comes a low-budget time travel movie, Predestination. I thought this movie was really interesting, and the scene stealer is Sarah Snook. She's a newcomer, an Aussie actress. We saw her in Jezebel, a horror movie, but she steals the show. She plays different characters and different genders.
Hmm.
If I could explain the plot succinctly, I would, but it is very confusing, but I like that.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of potential spoilers in it. It's a time travel story. You can learn that from the trailer. That's not a spoiler. So Sarah Snook and Ethan Hawke, they end up traveling at different points in their own timeline, and it gets a little confusing, but on purpose. And it deals a lot with very fascinating gender issues, trans issues as well, in a way that I think a lot of movies have been terrified to even touch. And what makes it extra fascinating is that this is based on a decades old short story by Robert Heinlein called All You Zombies. No, it is not a zombie movie. Shh, it's a metaphor. But this movie is fantastic. This is one of the better January releases in a long time. It's very intelligent. It's very inventive. There's a lot of very interesting sort of stray elements that just sort of build the world. There's the whole space travel thing that you heard in the clip. That's not really important to the plot. It's just cool.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of just neat stuff just thrown in because it's inventive and creative.
But the general outline is they're supposed to go back in time to stop a mass murderer.
A mad bomber.
A mad bomber.
But that's just sort of the setup. It's not really what it's about.
Right.
It's MacGuffin, basically. But it's I think it's fantastic. I saw it last year at South by Southwest, and it blew me away.
And Ethan Hawke having a very good run, what with Boyhood and now this.
Yeah, really good run. I love seeing him on screen, and I love how low-tech this movie is. The time travel device is a suitcase, and instead of the combination lock, they fiddle to the time that they're traveling to. I thought that was really clever. I love these guys. I can't wait to see what the Spierig brothers do with a bigger budget.
Yeah, well, I've loved them since Daybreakers. Their first movie, Undead, isn't very good, actually. But they're getting better and better every single time. They're getting more ambitious. This is fantastic, and this is definitely worth seeing in January of all months.
Okay, let's go to the opposite extreme, a big-budget thriller, Taken 3.
What I know is soon everyone you love will be dead.
What's your first priority here, Inspector?
My job is to bring you in.
My first priority is to protect the only one I have left.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to finish this.
Yes, that gravelly voice belongs to none other than Liam Neeson.
Ah, the hunky, hunky Liam Neeson.
So this is number three. What gets taken this time?
His wife's life. Mm. Also, the series' dignity. If I could give this like a
did
one...
it have it to begin with?
It did, actually. Like the first movie.
The
first movie is fantastic. It's also like a weird fascistic patriarchal power fantasy about how your dad was right about everything. But it was well made. Like, it was for divorced dads that go like, haha, I was right. And I'll kill everybody. And the second one was just a dumb sequel, just took it in weird directions. This one is borderline incompetent. This is a terrible movie. In almost every way a movie can be terrible. There's the editing is just terrible across the board. There's no pacing to it. Like, literally every shot lasts, I started counting, I was so bored, 2 seconds. Like, there's no sense of pacing. There's no sense of rhythm. There's no sense of drama and suspense. It's like The Fugitive with Liam Neeson on the run from Forrest Whitaker. Good casting. I like Forrest Whitaker. Everyone likes Forrest Forrest Whitaker. Yeah. Forrest Whitaker is basically incompetent. It's like if you had the fugitive was James Bond, and like the Deputy Gerard, played by Tommy Lee Jones, it was like his first day on the job. Like, there's no suspense. You know Liam Neeson's going to get away with everything from moment one.
I imagine there's no humor to it.
There's a couple of jokes here or there, but they're so sporadic. It takes itself really seriously, and it doesn't earn any of the drama. It's just really bad.
But these Takens, they do earn substantial box office. So.
Sure,
yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean they're good. That just means you got people into the theater.
And
that's
January.
That has more to do with marketing. It has more to do with sort of audience loyalty. Like, Taken 2 wasn't great, but I got through a lot of Taken 2 just because I remembered liking the characters so much from Taken 1 that there was a lot of residual goodwill that I was like, okay, this is really stupid, but I just like Maggie Grace's character. Sure, she can echolocate with grenades. Why not? Sure, let's do that. Like, I'll just enjoy it.
It's always fishy when a studio waits till the night before to screen the film for critics before it's released. That's why I haven't seen Taken 3. Yeah.
And but they didn't even tell some critics. I had to pay.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
the reviews so far have been pretty bad. I love Liam Neeson. I love him as an action hero, but this franchise just seems tired. To me, it seems like the hangover of the action franchise, where the first one was really great. They tried to replicate it with the second, didn't work, and then they go for a third. I'm glad
this
series is
ending. It's no Expendables, is what you're saying.
No Expendables.
Okay, speaking of franchises, the new Marvel movie Ant-Man, we got a sneak peek into it this week. It's coming out in the summer. Here's a clip from a new trailer.
This is your chance to earn that look in your daughter's eyes, to become the hero that she already thinks you are. It's not about saving our world. It's about saving theirs. Scott, I need you to be the Ant-Man.
Okay, and that's Michael Douglas there and a confused Paul Rudd as the new Ant-Man.
Yeah.
There's a funny line, right? But it seems so heavy with that music.
Exactly. This is why I'm so confused by what this tone of the movie is going to be, because with Edgar Wright previously involved and then Adam McKay coming aboard to write the script along with Paul Rudd, it seems like it's going to be really funny. And then that trailer starts and it is so dark and brooding. I love Michael Douglas's voice, but it's so serious. And then there's the one line at the end, which is funny, but it seems really tacked on and kind of awkward.
Well, I think what Marvel is trying to do here is pull the rug out from people. They like to be unexpected. Like when the first Guardians of the Galaxy teaser came out and it had Uga Chaka and everyone's like, what the heck is this? Star Wars with a 70s soundtrack? It paid off very, very well. I think with Ant-Man, everyone is expecting it to be very funny. I think that's the idea. And here what we're going to do is it's like they took like a traditional Michael Douglas trailer from like the early 1990s. Like take the trailer from Disclosure and then like 80 seconds into it, here's Ant-Man. What? Like that's kind of the gag. We're going to take this as a serious film and it's going to happen to have Ant-Man and Paul Rudd and some humor into it. Whether or not that's a good idea, I don't know. Honestly, this looks like the most traditional, old school, pulpy superhero movie to come out of Marvel.
It looks like a heist movie almost.
It is a heist movie, actually. Like, that's actually in the official plot description. It's something just really sort of traditional and conventional about it. But I do trust that Marvel has earned some goodwill, much like the folks at Taken did until Taken 3. So we'll see like where it goes here.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a troubled production. Who knows? Who knows where it's going to go? This is like the biggest question mark on their slate.
Is this their big release for the summer?
After Avengers.
Yes, and I was dubious about a raccoon and a tree being able to work, and Guardians was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So you never know.
You never know. All right. And a movie that is being resurrected from the dead from David O. Russell. It's a long time David O. Russell project that he shelved. It was originally called Nailed.
Yeah.
And now it's called Accidental Love. And tell us about this one.
Well, okay. So David O. Russell, somewhat earlier in his career, before he started collecting all of the Oscar nominations, he did an independent comedy about a woman who gets a nail in the head and falls in love with a Jake Gyllenhaal senator man. And they decide to sort of fix healthcare. But there were enormous problems with the production. Their funding got cut multiple times. The production kept up. I interviewed Jake Gyllenhaal like 2 years ago, and he said that the movie was done, but they still haven't finish, like, I think the ending, or like one major scene.
When she got the nail in the head.
Was that the
that
exact
was the,
scene?
The scene that they hadn't done.
Oh.
Yeah, so
this
like
they. This is played by Jessica Biel.
This is played by Jessica Biel. So it's just, it's a messy, trouble production. It's not going to be the oldest movie to finally get a release this year, but it's going to be a big.
And why did David O. Russell walk away from it? Do we know?
I think all the financial problems in the end, he just had to walk away. And now his style has evolved so much that it seems so strange that this film's coming out now, 7 years later. And also, if you look at IMDb, it says directed by David O. Russell in brackets as Stephen Green. Who is Stephen Green? I have no idea. But this trailer looks bizarre. Accidental Love. Terrible title.
Yes, absolutely. I preferred it as Nailed. I would have preferred it as pretty much, you know what, call this Taken 3. I'm fine with it. So much better.
Or Taken 4.
Taken-ish.
Why not?
Why not?
Yeah.
All right. I want to thank you both very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's William Bibbiani, film editor for Crave Online, and Alicia Malone, host of Malone's Movie Minute. All right, one final thing to do before you watch a movie is to listen to a radio show.
That is certainly
yours,
the case.
Warren Olney.
That is the one to listen to, no doubt. It'll begin at 1 o'clock, and it'll be good. We're going to go to France, of course, and to hear more about what's happening there and what the implications might be for the future. Hear more, too, about who were the people that conducted these atrocities and why they might have done it. We're also going to be talking about Iran. Both President Obama and President Rouhani of Iran have been making statements lately that suggest to some people that there really might be the possibility of a nuclear agreement, although then, of course, you run up against Israel, which thinks this might be really an existential question.
Mm-hmm.
They're unlikely to come around. And you have Congress members, of course, that already want to institute more sanctions. But there does seem to be some progress there, and it's still a very interesting subject. So we're going to have a lot of fun with that.
All right. Well, thank you, Warren.
Indeed.
To the Point at 1 o'clock in about 15 minutes from now. And before that, on this program, Hollywood isn't just an idea. It's a sign. And lots of tourists want to see it up close. Residents of Beechwood Canyon are fed up and they've gone to some extreme measures to stop the influx of GPS-enabled gawkers. That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Back in 1923, a real estate company erected a huge sign in the Hollywood Hills. It advertised parcels of real estate called Hollywood Land. Now, the land is gone from the sign, and the sign has become an international landmark. Or maybe if you are a nearby resident, it's just a magnet for noisy, destructive tourists.
So, helicopters are everywhere now because I was on top. We've seen multiple helicopters. So now we're going to get the hell out of here.
One Canyon resident told The Hollywood Reporter that the situation now is a disaster waiting to happen. Gary Baum wrote about what's happening for The Reporter. He's senior writer there. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So it was a guy who lives in the neighborhood and actually works in the entertainment industry who told you that visitors to the sign are a disaster waiting to happen. What was he referring to?
He was referring to this influx of tourist traffic that's grown exponentially in the last half decade with the rise of GPS and the rise of just smartphones and their ability to bring people very close to the sign, getting people that used to blanch at the idea of getting right up close to the sign, braving the sort of devil's knot of those hills to that sign and the desire to just reach out and touch it.
So what are the residents, what are they experiencing with this influx?
They say that they are experiencing a tremendous amount of traffic and people walking in the middle of the street to take pictures, selfies. Various residents and tour bus operators spoke of intense confrontations, verbal confrontations, that they're experiencing people urinating in public, that they're experiencing all the different things you'd have with crowds, everything from alcohol and sex and drug use. Mainly what they're concerned about, they claim, is such an amount of congestion that emergency responders wouldn't necessarily be able to get up to their homes and other related areas to fight fires or to retrieve people in the event of, you know, things like heart attacks for the ambulances. At the top above the Hollywood sign is a place called Mount Lee, which is an important city services communications hub.
Yeah, and so they're afraid maybe a tourist will carelessly drop a cigarette and that'll start a forest fire, and then the trucks wouldn't be able to get up there to put out the fire.
Exactly. That's something that they bring up repeatedly.
Mm-hmm. And they've been pretty successful in fighting back by getting road closures and getting, actually, what I found most interesting in your article, navigation companies, that GPS companies like Garmin and Google even, to change the way that they direct people up there.
Yeah, they are an incredibly savvy, well-connected group of activists, a core group of several dozen people who, over the last few years, have leaned on and needled various municipal and commercial entities to do their bidding.
So how were they successful in getting Google and other companies to change their map functions?
Well, basically what they asked them to do is, when people look for directions to the sign, that instead of being directed through their streets, that they are directed to other viewing spots. They're directed to the Griffith Park Observatory or the Hollywood and Highland Shopping Center, which has a view of the sign, that they are not directed through their narrow streets, which of course are public streets.
Right, public streets. And has that been successful in staving off a bunch of tourists?
It has clearly not been particularly successful. It has, according to them, it's dropped a certain amount of traffic, but the internet has a way of getting around these things.
This reminds me a little bit of the fight for beach access in Malibu.
It is a very similar situation to the Malibu beach access wars, where you have wealthy homeowners who are fighting over basically the right of the general public to connect with public resources. And they have gone to the mat over that right and threatened to go to court and have talked at various municipal levels to make these things happen. You know, it's part of these larger ideas of the public's right to common spaces versus private property and private individuals' rights to basically serenity.
Well, what do they say when those arguments are raised? What do they say when people say, well, this is a public street, this is a public park, you can't close off access to it?
They say essentially, yes, but. They try to limit the focus on quality of life issues and focus on safety issues. They try to broaden the focus beyond them to concerns about the safety of the tourists themselves, of hikers, and the idea that there is simply not the possibility in practice of proper enforcement by city and county services to be able to handle the influx of this tourism. And that since that's not possible, that they shouldn't be having to deal with their neighborhood turning into, as many of them put it, some comparative site to Disneyland.
So what do they want? Do they want tourists banned entirely?
Yes. I mean, a lot of them would like to see the entire area devoid of tourism and rerouted through other sites. They speak of having visitor centers or trams or other options at a further distance. And some just say, you know, to hell with it. You shouldn't be able to get that close to this sign, which is not Old Faithful on even ground in an easily accessible space.
What do you think is going to happen there? The city councilman, Tom Labonge, who's been at the center of this issue, is retiring, and there's an election in March to replace him. What's going to happen?
Well, we're already seeing this issue become a wedge issue in the upcoming campaign. It's a political hot potato. Really, the main challenge with the sign is that it's always been in locally a third rail. The city elders, the city structure has never really understood the sign, has always been behind the eight ball with the sign, has never really understood its importance to tourism, and has never really had a governing philosophy to deal with it. So we're still talking about fanciful ideas with no real financial or practical way of dealing with them. The ideas that are discussed, trams, trolleys, shuttles, visitor centers, all sorts of things, are really years and years, if at all, off into the future. And we have a problem that we are actively dealing with that is really a true powder keg right now. And it's really a testament to the city's failure on a policy level to think big picture.
Gary Baum, senior writer for The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've come to the end of a very productive week, Julie Myers.
It's like we've reached the top and we are right next to the Hollywood sign.
We are.
In a lot of ways. So clearly our listeners had a lot to say about this whole Hollywood sign thing. Vicky Tiki Tavi weighed in on Facebook. She says that the people who live around the Hollywood sign sound like the Malibu residents who block access to beaches. They want all the benefits of living next to a beautiful landmark, but don't want to pay the price. Justito Watt says that his parents live across the street from a baseball diamond. They get their windows broken by fly balls all the time. And it sucks, but they understand that it's part of what happens when you live across the street from a baseball diamond. If you don't want to deal with annoying tourists, don't live next to a world-famous landmark. Problem solved. And Joel Carlos says, this is so ridiculous. Tourists bring money to LA. Money that we need. We should be doing everything we can to make them feel welcome in our city, not letting a small elite chase them away. They go home, they tell their friends, and that's more money coming back into LA. But Carrie Saxton says that the fire risk from dropped cigarettes is a real threat, and the tourists who stand in the street on Beechwood Canyon to take photos are putting themselves and drivers in danger. There are plenty of places to safely take pictures of the sign. Go to them if you want to take your stupid selfies. To which Jean Crochet responds, anyone want to guess where Carrie Saxton lives?
Ooh, it's getting nasty out there.
So if you want to get in on the Facebook nastiness, we'll be there all week.
Or you can just hike up to the Hollywood sign and experience it in person.
I'll be reciting these comments from the top.
All right, Julie Myers, have a great weekend.
You too.
Whatever you do. Whatever, wherever you hike.
To the laundromat.
Okay. If you want to weigh in, our Twitter at KCRW Press Play, Facebook KCRW Press Play. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.